I was chief of media relations for the Army.
Okay.
And part of Pete Williams' rationale was, okay, we've got a land combat war about to start. And so infantry officer with the CIB and, you know, jump wings and all that sort of stuff made sense to him, I guess. I know. Anyway, he asked me, and I wanted to go. I guess part of a rather vivid memory was when I'd been selected, I knew I was going in a matter of a week or 10 days. I don't remember. It wasn't very long to get ready to go. I had to get equipment issued and so forth, which I did. But I remember going to a meeting in Pete Williams' office up at OSD that had the major editors, news directors from the four networks, CNN being the fourth, Washington Post, New York Times. I mean, the big guns were in his office, and they were talking about how we were going to cover this war. I sat in the back of the room and listened. So then I also made the rounds, Fred Francis at NBC, who was a defense correspondent, you know, talked with Fred. What do you think I ought to do? How do I prepare? And David Martin and you know, the big guys up there. And they had some pretty good advice. I don't know if I talked to Katie Couric. She had left. She was on the Today Show by then, but she had been Fred Francis's assistant and knew Katie well. And she had gone over with President Bush for Thanksgiving for a lot of Today Show. Anyway, so I talked to the media. I listened to the media in Mr. Williams' office and tried to learn as much as I could before a quick deployment. Flew from Washington to London, and from London into Dahran, and was just it was a commercial airline, British Airways. And funny story, whether you're interested in this or not, but I was sitting sort of toward the back of the plane, and there were a lot of journalists on board. A guy sitting next to me was a journalist, and I had a window seat, and I looked out, and this big white limousine, I mean, the longest limousine you've ever seen, pulled up to the ramp in Dahran, and I said, boy, there must be somebody really important on this plane for that limo to be here. Do you know who? And he didn't know, and I didn't know. And so people got off the plane. I was one of the last ones off. And Navy Captain Mike Sherman, who was the JIB director at the time, he had taken the initial pool in August over and stayed. And he had set up the Joint Information Bureau. Mike was waiting for me, and little salute at the bottom of the stairs, and he said, here's your limo. And we got in the limousine and went to the terminal, and there were Saudi customs people, and they just walked me right through, and there was this huge line of people going through customs, and walked through, and limo was waiting on the other side, and we went to the JIB. We had the whole Dahran International Hotel for our JIB, or we had the second floor of it. Plus, we all had rooms in the hotel, agreement that our food was paid for by the Saudi government. Our rooms were paid for. Our laundry was paid for. You just left it outside the door, and your uniform came back all starched and ready to go. And all the equipment, the fax machines, the copy machines, the telephones, all provided by the Saudi government. And that was all set up for me. And Mike and I had about a 5-day transition. This is starting 1st of December when I arrived. And he flew back to Hollywood, and I was the JIB director. And it happened pretty fast, but I brought with me the ground rules and guidelines that had been developed up to that point. I don't know what the date of those were, but late November. And one of my main jobs was to bring those ground rules and guidelines to the working media there and work out the details. How were we going to cover this war? And that's what I did. I started with meetings. Mike had already set up pool coordinators for each type of media. We had a print coordinator, a TV coordinator, radio, and photographers. And so they were elected representatives from the media. And I met with them, and we went over line by line, word by word, what could they live with? You know, what was my guidance from Mr. Williams and others? And I'm in constant communications, meanwhile, with Navy Captain Ron Wildermuth, who was General Schwarzkopf's PAO in Riyadh. And realize I'm hundreds of miles away in Dahran, but that's where the media was. That's where the troops had been arriving. That was the center of activity for Desert Shield up until that point. And that's where the jib was. When I arrived, we had registered about 600 reporters with the jib. Now I say registered, they signed in where they were from, contact information, there in Saudi and who they were working for. The Saudi government actually accredited the media, so we didn't accredit them, we registered. But there was a feeling that 600 number was pretty high because it had accumulated since August, and people had come and they'd left and more had come in. And so I wanted to purge that list and be sure we knew who was there and if we had the most up-to-date information. So we started doing that. You know, I gave the list to the print pool coordinator, Larry Jolodon from USA Today. So he said, okay, here's people that have left, and here's new that have come in, and they're still here, and so forth. So we got that list worked out, and turned out that by 20th of December or so, after a couple three weeks, we were down to 285 reporter journalists. And by that's sound men, cameramen, correspondent. So when I speak of media, it was, you know, a photographer, a radio broadcaster, but also the technical support. So we had 285, pretty manageable group. And so I also met with each type of media, all the TV people, and this is sound, camera, on-camera folks. And we went through these guidelines and ground rules. How are we going to do this? And they made their comments, and then I'd meet with another group and got their comments and the other group. And then of course, every step of the way, I had to go back to Riyadh to Ron Wildermuth or his deputy to get a blessing from General Schwarzkopf's office, and back to Pete Williams or Bob Taylor, Mr. Williams' deputy, and get their blessings. Now, when they would get a change that we had made, say, back in the Pentagon, then Mr. Williams went back to Washington Post, New York Times, ABC, and so forth, the Associated Press and all, with those changes. So it was really a collaborative effort. But the point I want to make is it was done with the news media. And in my case, these are reporters, many of whom had been there since August, had been out in the field with the troops, had been to training, had interviewed commanders and privates. And so it was, okay, how do we do this? What size pools, composition of the pools, how do we get them out there? How do they get their stories back? And by the 14th of January, we had the final ground rules and guidelines. So over a month in the making of exactly how we were, what was going to be our rules. We also had worked out the pool plan as to how we were going to notify journalists that were in the pool, how they'd be selected, and where they'd go. And the pool operations became Annex F of the operations order for Desert Storm. And I can get into the complications of, you know, how it worked and so forth, but we had tested it. We had formed pools, and on the 2nd of January, we alerted them, you know, went and knocked on their hotel room door and said, okay, it's time to go, because the original plan was that we were going to quietly go get them and send them off, because the war was about to start. In fact, that didn't work, because they had two roommates that were also journalists, and when we came to get them, they knew. So a major change was that we weren't going to wait till the last minute, like the national press pool had done when they deployed from Washington to go to Panama or to Grenada or whatever, where it was very secret, hush-hush. We decided that we were going to pre-position the journalists. We were going to make up the pools, a pool of 18 to go to the Army, a pool of 18 to go to the Marines, and then as many other seven member pools as we could, and get them out to the units, and they would be with the unit, and they would learn the unit, and in many cases they would learn the plans of the unit, and I can go into that in some detail. But we, after some tests and training, and we issued equipment to them, we put their helmets together with them, showed them how to get into MOP 4 with the gas mask fitted properly and the clothing and so forth, and first aid classes. We had a lot of training for the journalists to go out there. We got the pools, sent them out, and they were with the units. They went to 7th Corps, 18th Airborne Corps, to the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force, and they were pool members. And then we kept, as the military commanders would accept more, I'd send out pools of seven. And that would be three television, a sound man, a cameraman, and a correspondent, a radio journalist, a photographer, and two print journalists. And this had been agreed to back in December. That was a good composition to send people out. And so when we had space, an agreement with the commander to send another pool out, I would go to the print pool coordinator and say, okay, I need two journalists to go to the 101st Airborne or to go to the Marines. And then I'd go to the photography coordinator, I need another photographer for this pool. So the way they prioritized who would go was by their time in country. If their organization, say Associated Press, had been there since August 13th or whatever the date was, then AP got a slot. The New York Times had come in October and they were the next longest, then they got a slot, because we had a lot of people arriving, Johnny Come Lately's, just before the war started. And it was done by seniority of time in country. But that got all the big networks and publications pool slots, and they got out there with the units and were ready to go to war. That got a little long-winded. There's a lot of things I can go back to, but that's sort of what I was doing on the big picture, was to develop this pool concept, and I was using the Seidel Commission report and a lot of other information of how it worked, and after-action reports from Panama and Grenada where it didn't work, and we were trying to fix those. But I wasn't in a vacuum. I had plenty of Pentagon support, and I had plenty of support from Central Command there in General Schwarzkopf's headquarters in Riyadh. I knew maybe 6 hours in advance when the air war was going to start, but I was the only one in the gym that knew. The reporters didn't know, although about, I forget what the flight time was, let's say an hour before, we were right there at Dahran Air Force Base. That's where the hotel and the jib was. Well, just about every plane there took off right after the and so pretty good indication that the air war was about to start. They knew something was going on, and of course then we had live from Baghdad with Peter Arnett and such, as the bombs are coming in. We saw it live, which was fascinating. You know, we'd seen them taken off. I knew what was going on, not the details of it, but just the, you know, the hour when the first bombs would be dropped and the first cruise missiles would hit. And so the reporters who were with the Air Force, who were with the Navy as Tomahawk missiles took off, they got to film that. They filmed the takeoffs. They filmed the missiles being fired, and so you had that instant news. And it took a while, and we can talk about delays. So you do a videotape of a Tomahawk missile firing out on a cruiser or destroyer or whatever. You got to get it back to the jib if you're a pool reporter, and that became a major logistical challenge, was getting those stories and videos and cassette tapes that the radio guys had physically back where they were shared with everybody else. Again, these were pool reports. So, you were working for National Public Radio, or you were working for CNN, but your report, video, transcript came back to the jib and was available to everybody. The war started, the first pools were deployed. Of course, the ground combat had not started yet. And then when the plane started coming back, we had reporters at the air bases, and they could interview the pilots. And then you had the live shots from Baghdad, which was exciting too. That got old after a while. You know, you take pictures of takeoffs and landings and missiles being fired, and you talk to pilots when they get back. And the air war went on for a long time. Yeah. What I was doing back in the jib was getting these pool reports back in, and we had a process which we can give a long detailed discussion of, but it was a security review, not censorship. Sort of adamant about that, but the only thing we reviewed, any of that material that came back for, was were they following the ground rules? And they were, there were 14 of them or whatever, and the guidelines, and that's the only criteria that we had. Not was it well written? Was there a technical mistake in it? The question was, were the ground rules violated? And most everything that came back to the jib had already been reviewed at the journalist's level. And by that, I mean he had a PAO or she had a PAO with them. They were there as the video was being made. They got the copy of the story, reviewed it right there with the ground rules right next to it, and said, okay, you followed all the ground rules. You didn't talk about any future operations. You didn't talk about any weaknesses that this unit had. You didn't give away this, that, or, you know, the things that would put American lives in danger. It's cleared. So when it came back to the Joint Information Bureau in Tehran, it was already cleared. I didn't have to watch the videotape. I didn't have to listen to the recording or read the story. It came back. I saw that it was already cleared, gave it back to the print pool coordinator, and he had a massive copy machine, and they made copies for everybody. Everybody in the jib, they faxed them back to their bureaus in the States. They transmitted the videos and the audios and so forth back. The only time I looked at a pool report that was coming back was if there was a disagreement, if the journalist on the ground and the public affairs officer couldn't agree that there was a violation or there wasn't a violation, then it was flagged. And up in the corner, usually in red ink, it said flagged. That's where I came into play. It came back flagged. Let's say it was a print story. Then I saw it was flagged. I read the story. I called Nick Horak from the Chicago Tribune, who at that point was the print pool coordinator. And I said, Nick, we got to go over this. So it would be the two of us would go over the story with the ground rules and guidelines right there. And Nick would say, you know, you're right. He does talk about what they're doing tomorrow. And that's a violation of discussion of future operations. And so Nick would take the story, change this word to this word, or cross out this line, put his initials in the corner, and then it got reproduced and went out to everybody. If the pool coordinator for whatever medium it was and I couldn't agree, we sent it back to the Pentagon. And it went right to Mr. Williams, and usually in about 15 or 20 minutes, I'd get an answer back because he had called the Washington Post, CNN, whatever, and he had his contact, and they reviewed it. There were only five stories that came back and that went back to the Pentagon, and four of those got cleared to be released as they were, and one of them, the editor made the changes. He said, "You're right. It violates the ground rules. We agreed to these ground rules." And so he changed this and changed that. And the changes were somewhat extensive because it gave away the left hook that we were doing. I mean, it was a big, it located way out in the West, way, way, way out in the West. The tactical plan that we were executing, and we didn't want Saddam to know that we were that far west coming around to him. And so the changes were made. The editor asked that it be retyped, so you couldn't figure out, you know, what all had, and so we retyped and that went out. But that's how the security review process worked. And most of this film, audio, and print would come to King Khalid Military City, because that's where the logistics bases were for the deployed troops that were out there fighting and so forth. And then it was flown to Dahran. I mean, it was a media flight bringing this material back, and it usually get in about 10 o'clock at night. So from 10 o'clock to 11, I was looking at what needed to be looking at and facilitating the process of it being reproduced and passed out to everybody. Now, sometimes during the day, the Marines would drive a story back from Al Jabal back to Dahran, so it, you know, might come in at 2 in the afternoon or whenever. But as soon as something came in from the pool reporters, we would look at it, and most all the time it was good to go. They were very careful about the ground rules because they were out there with the units, and if it you know, meant danger to that unit, it meant danger to them. And so those stories came back, and they were provided. And that's how the American people found out what was going on all over the war, was from all these pool reports coming from this battalion or this company or this aircraft carrier or this destroyer or, you know, whatever it was, or this Air Force base. They all came into Dahran, and everybody got copies, and then the bureau chiefs wrote the stories, or, you know, sent material back to the states. And so what resulted in was very complete stories that had the input from all the reports and the briefings. General Neill speaking in Riyadh, General Kelly speaking back in the Pentagon, General Schwarzkopf doing his press conferences and presentations. So there was a lot of information coming in from, you know, this one print reporter who was with 2nd Squad, A Company, 1st Battalion, you know, whatever. He was out there seeing it, and he provided his input. But then there was the big picture that Schwarzkopf was portraying and that General Kelly was portraying back in the States. So that's how the war was covered, and how we got such broad and I'd say accurate coverage of what our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and Coast Guard were doing out there. I think the Desert Storm effect, two things. I think a lot of members of the military who were very skeptical or more than that, anti-press, anti-media, realized that they had a story to be told, and the press could do a pretty good job of it. They were very proud of their units, of course. And so I think we developed a lot of trust and confidence across the board at the general officer level, at the battalion commander or brigade commander level, on down to the company commanders, who young captains, lieutenants, and so forth. They were just begging for reporters to come tell their story. We didn't have to sell the young officers on it. We had to sell some of the more senior officers on it. But I think they got a lot more trust and confidence in the media. On the other side of that coin, I think the members of the news media, all types, who actually got out there with the units, developed a great respect for our military, which they hadn't had before that. I had one memorable discussion with a group of reporters in the Joint Information Bureau there in Dahran. They said, well, your equipment doesn't work. We know that the night vision goggles are killing pilots. They don't work because 60 Minutes said so. It was a big piece on 60 Minutes that said just that, you know, that these night vision goggles are killing pilots. We know that your helicopters can't fly in the desert because the sand erodes the blades of the helicopter. So you're not going to have any helicopters out there. And we know that the M16 rifles and the rest of your, if they get any sand in them, you know, they don't work. So you can't fly. You can't, see at night, and you can't shoot. So this is going to be a disaster out there. And oh, by the way, we know that your commanders are corrupt, and you know they're not really leaders, and your soldiers aren't well trained because we saw it on TV. And that was the way a lot of them went into it. Well, let me tell you, when they after they saw the war, they saw how the equipment worked. They loved the night vision goggles and saw that, you know, the M1 tank did work in the desert. The M16 rifle worked in the desert. The leaders were marvelous. And that spread, I think, throughout the news media. That, you know, when they came back, when they were veterans of Desert Storm, and they started saying, you know, we need to look at the military again, because what our preconceptions were wrong. And so that was maybe a temporary change, but I think that was a change that both the military and the news media gained a lot more respect for each other. And I think it did last. Because you had, when we got into Bosnia, you had really savvy, commanders who had dealt with the media in Desert Storm, the Bill Nashes and so forth, bring them on, you know, I'm going to take them with me. I want the news media to cover my story and tell my story. And, we knew how to do it. PAOs were a lot more educated. I think you know, we probably did a whole lot of our changes to our curriculum at DINFOS. So from the very beginning, young PAOs were learning how to do it, and I think the PAOs out there in the units had a lot more respect, were a much more important part of the commander's staff. You know, you listen to your lawyers, but you listen to your PAO too, and he or she could, in many cases, keep you out of trouble or maybe help get you out of trouble. So I think it did carry over. There was a lesson learned that I want to mention, and that was the fact that the longer the reporters were with the unit, we found, the better the stories were. And this led to embedding, a word that we didn't have in Desert Storm. Let's put that reporter with the unit in Germany. And then when they drive to Bosnia, Herzegovina, they know what the unit's like. They know the people, and they're going to get good coverage as they go in. We referred to it sometimes as the Stockholm effect. I think it was a bank robbery in Stockholm, Sweden, and the hostages got very familiar with the bank robbers, to the point that they took their side. And that's what we call the Stockholm effect. And I think that works with the journalists. The better they know the unit, the better they're going to report with the unit. The longer they're with them, there's a built camaraderie. And that, I think, is something we learned, and let us trust the journalists a little more. Not to say there weren't exceptions, but that was a lesson we learned. Well, I look at it probably from a historical point of view, because in developing those ground rules, we went back and got the ground rules from World War II, actually some of the censorship rules from World War I. MacArthur was heading up the Census Bureau for a while as a major. And when you look back at World War II, we had embedded media. You know, you had the Ernie Piles and reporters staying with the unit for a long time, talking about my boys are doing this, that, and the other thing. I look back when people would criticize the number of journalists that were actually in the pools. We had 1,095 at the high point in the Joint Information Bureau, 1,095 journalists. We only had about 160 some that were out there with the frontline units. You couldn't send 1,000 out there. There wasn't room for them. There wasn't room on the helicopters, in the Bradley fighting vehicles, and for every journalist that went out with the frontline unit, took the place of a soldier, airman, marine. And so a commander, if he said, I'll take 7 journalists, he had to give up 7 marines because they only had the transportation. We didn't make vehicles for journalists to go out in. In the situation of Saudi Arabia, you couldn't just drive your Toyota out across the desert. You had to go with the military. But I would turn people back to Normandy. The number of reporters that went ashore with the troops on D-Day, 27. So there you go. When our war started in Saudi Arabia, we had 130 or so out there on the front lines, right there with the frontline troops. So I think the way it was for you all in Afghanistan and Iraq really was an evolution from total censorship in World War I to some embedding in World War II and censorship to the Korean War, to Vietnam. I was a platoon leader and company commander and infantry company commander for a year in Vietnam. I never saw a journalist, not once in a year. And that was okay. You know, I know they were there. I know they were reporting. I know my fiance and my mom and dad and brothers and sisters were watching what was going on in Vietnam. But I didn't know what was being reported. I didn't have a TV over there. So, you know, for a year, I didn't see a journalist. And other than Stars and Stripes, I didn't see much of any media coverage of the war. We learned a lot. In Vietnam, of course, that was free and open. Journalists could go anywhere, anytime. I guess, again, I wasn't doing it. I had another job then. We didn't do a very good job in Operation Just Cause in Panama. We activated the national media pool, and from what I've read, stayed in a warehouse most of the time and didn't see much of the action. Grenada, same thing. We had a concept. We deployed the pool, but we didn't really get the kind of open access that we wanted. And we tried to fix all that. We had the SADL report. I had some very good guidelines from General Colin Powell, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, that he had done. I think it was in, let's say it was May. I don't know why that, May of 90, before there even was a Desert Shield. But, I think these were guidelines, by the chairman as a result of the SADL Commission and some of the other studies. So we really built on, some failures. I think it worked, but I also think that Desert Storm was very unique. Desert Storm is not a model for Afghanistan. It's not a model for Iraq whatsoever. Bosnia, I was the director of chief of information for NATO over there in Sarajevo. Whole different world. We didn't have any pools. Reporters all had cars and apartments, and you know, they went wherever they wanted to and talked to anybody they wanted to. We had a press conference daily or weekly with the mostly with the non-government organizations that were working there, but we had a military representative too. I don't think we can look at Desert Storm as a model for the future. It was a culmination of the past. We learned, it worked, I think, for Desert Storm, but to take it as a package and say, okay, here's the way you must do it or should do it in the future, I don't see it as that. I think you have to get your own model for Iraq. We certainly got our own model for Bosnia, and for future conflicts. I would hope they'd go back and learn, pick the best pieces that apply for current or future operations, but it's certainly not one size fits all. Desert Storm was really unique. Well, I think one thing that should be drawn from that was how limited the ground rules and guidelines were. I mean, there were like 14 of them. I mean, it wasn't, you know, wasn't very many. And they were only focused on operational security, that something would not go to a sophisticated enemy that would endanger American lives. We really tried to simplify it, and the journalists bought into that. They understood every reason, you know, why there couldn't be a discussion of a future operation or a weakness of a particular piece of equipment or a unit's manpower strength, or, you know, things that could tip off the enemy. So I would say if there's a lesson to go forward, minimize your control over the journalists, but explain to them why. We had a group of journalists who had been in Saudi Arabia for a long time, for months and months. They understood why the ground rules were the way they were. They'd helped develop them word by word, and they implemented them out there. The problems we had was with journalists who arrived the day before the war started, just brand new. The agricultural editor from the Peoria Star Journal or what, you know, shows up, and he gets to go out with the unit, and he hadn't bought in. He signed the ground rules that he would abide by them, but he didn't have any understanding for them, or no commitment to them. So I think if we're going forward, minimize your controls, educate, train the journalists so they're familiar with your operations, with your equipment, and then I think they'll serve you well. They'll serve the American people well. And they'll serve the military well. Because even though Molly Moore was with Lieutenant General Boomer in his headquarters with the Marines, she was only seeing a small part of the war, the Marine part of the war from a pretty high level. And somebody else that was out with an armor unit way out to the left flank, they had a little piece of the story, but it all came together. And it all got shared. And of course, I'm an advocate for the pools that happened for Desert Storm. I'm not saying that's the way to go in the future. But if the Washington Post only had Molly Moore's story from General Boomer's perspective, then that's what the Washington Post got. Their readers got was just her story. One publication or one network doesn't have enough people to cover an operation that size. Now, we realize how huge Desert Storm was. So they got the advantage of sharing the stories. The journalists hated it. I mean, they really hated sharing their products because they were loyal to the New York Times or to the Louisville Courier Journal or wherever they were from. A quick story on Bob Simon. Bob Simon from CBS was in that initial test on the 2nd of January where we sent them out to send a pool or pools out to the units for 24 or 48 hours. It was a short period of time, and we brought them all back into the Joint Information Bureau. While Bob Simon was back, he looked on another network. I don't know which one it was, but let's say NBC, and saw his commentary out there with UNIT on a rival network. And he blew up. I mean, he was just beside himself, hollering, and, you know, this is not going to happen. I'm out of the pools. I will never be in a pool again. My training, my professionalism, you know, my dedication to CBS, it's all going to competition. And so he came and saw me and said, I'm out of here. Take my name off the list. I am not going on another pool. I refuse to share my great stories with anybody else. Count me out. A few days later, I saw him and his TV crew in a type of fatigues. I think they were Saudi fatigues. Anyhow, military uniform slipping out through the kitchen of the Dalaran International Hotel. And later found out they got in their Jeep packed with gas cans and so forth and drove up to the Kuwaiti border. And he decided, well, you know, I'm going to do an exclusive from inside occupied Kuwait. And he and his crew left their Jeep and walked over across the border and started filming. And then an Iraqi Jeep pulled up that changed his life. They arrested him and put him in jail in Baghdad, and that's where he saw the war from. But all of that was because he did not want to share his information. He was going to do exclusives for CBS and nobody but CBS. And quite a few of them felt that way. You know, I'm a great journalist. I don't want my stuff showing up someplace else. So that was an interesting aspect and there are 100 stories like that. I learned a whole lot. I didn't mention the PT test. let me throw that in if you got a minute.
Sure.
I won't bore you with the background of how it came about, but in the operations order, NFX for Desert Storm, it said that the journalists would be physically fit. Makes sense. You're going out with young soldiers and Iraqis got artillery and, you know, everything else. You may have to run with all of your equipment out of an artillery barrage to get in that Bradley fighting vehicle and move out of the area or whatever. And we did not want a young soldier to have to carry the equipment of some journalist who wasn't able to carry his or her, you know, typewriter and gas mask and, you know, all the other equipment, flak jacket that they had. We didn't want the journalists putting any of our young soldiers in harm's way because they weren't physically fit. And let me tell you, the journalists were not physically fit. When I got there, they weren't. And so, you know, cleared it with my boss in Riyadh. And Mr. Williams back in the Pentagon. And so, we told the journalists, in order to be on a pool, you've got to be physically fit. We've got to evaluate you and, see if you're in good enough shape to go with our young soldiers to war. So we made a really lenient PT test. We adopted the Navy's mile and a half run and some really slow times to pass and some sit-ups and some push-ups. And that was it. But every afternoon at 4 o'clock, if you wanted to show up, I gave the men the PT test. And because we were in Saudi Arabia, the women did their test at 10 o'clock in the morning with a female Navy yeoman giving them their test because the sexes were separated. The gym was open in the morning for the women and in the afternoon for the men. But it really got their attention. One CNN correspondent who really wanted to go cover the war was a two-pack-a-day smoker. He quit smoking cold turkey and lost 30 pounds.
Wow.
And he needed to. And they were jogging and they were exercising. They were using the gym. They were doing push-ups in their room. And so we made a point with them. Got a lot of comedy out of Doonesbury. Ran a whole long series on the PT tests for the journalists over there. I got a lot of grief from the big guns back in the States, the editors, and so how can you make my journalists do push-ups to go out to cover the war? Well, I got away with it, and the journalists appreciated. Another quick story: we were teaching them how to wear their chemical protective clothing because we thought Saddam would use it against us, which we were very, very prepared for. Andy Pastor from the Wall Street Journal had a full beard that he'd had for 18 years. And so we're trying on gas masks. And I said, Andy, you can't get a SEAL if you've got that beard. He said, I'll be right back. And he went back to his room and he shaved off his 18-year-old beard so he could wear his protective mask properly. That's the kind of attention and seriousness that we got from them. So it wasn't just the PT test. It was understanding that they were going into harm's way and they needed to be fit. They needed to know how their equipment worked. And that was good. Well, we had a British chemical officer who came to the Joint Information Bureau and built the basement of the hotel into a sealed area that we could go to during Scud attacks because we were right there at the airbase and we had a lot of Scud attacks. I've got a piece of Scud missile that I brought back with me that landed nearby. But we knew when the Scuds were taking off and we'd get an alert right away while they were still in the air, get our chemical gear and get down in the basement. And then he would seal that basement so that no air could from the outside could get in down there. And we explained to the journalists that they were welcome to come, but you had to come right away. You couldn't change your mind and come in later because that would break the seal. So we had a handful of journalists, Carl Rochelle and a couple others that. They volunteered. They said, okay, we're going to stay out here and we're going to broadcast. And they would do live reporting of Scud attacks outside, knowing that if the chemicals went off, and they weren't reporting with their masks on, but there's a great clip of Carl Rochelle scrambling to get his on out there as one landed nearby. But we had hundreds. We had the staff from the hotel. We had all the journalists, hundreds, depending on before or during the war. And we protected them as best we could. But some of them made that tough choice that they would stay out and report live as the missiles hit. We called them our canaries. And we had TVs down in the basement, so we're watching their reports. Out there, and we knew if they fell over that we probably didn't want to go out of the basement. So after supper every night I would do three or four interviews with Egyptian TV or Japanese newspaper or you know, wherever to explain the jib and what was going on and how we came up with the pools and what they were doing out there and to give them access to the pool material that was coming back in, which they were thrilled about since they couldn't get out there. But they were about to have an uprising, a revolt, a demonstration at the White House and at the jib and all over because the American PAOs were only letting Americans cover the war. And every night it was, you know, they had a time slot and they'd come in so I got really good at talking about this to international journalists, but haven't done one in years and years and years and years. So thanks for the opportunity to talk on camera again.